from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of the upcoming AIA Architects Home Tour.
I get to chat with author Barb Shoup about her new novel, An American Tune.
And I'll talk with site-specific composer and performer Nat Evans, plus there'll be our arts calendar we call
What'll We do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Ever wonder what it's like to work with an architect to design the home of your dreams? Well, you can have that experience vicariously at the Architects Home Tour, a self-guided tour of seven Indianapolis homes designed by indie architects coming up on September 22nd and 23rd. Sharon Gamble invited Mark Beebe, chair of the event, to tell us more, and Mark designed one of the tour homes, too.
So, Mark, I'm guessing that the Architects Home Tour started for some particular reason. Were you there at the beginning, or do you know the story?
I was not there at the very beginning. We've done this tour every other year for quite a while now, and what we realize is that this is a great opportunity as architects to show to the public what we do from the standpoint that architecture is really a blending of art and science. And so for homeowners to be able to walk through homes that we've designed and to be able to explain to them some of our background and the history and the process of how we got to the finished product is a great opportunity to really demonstrate what we really do.
Mm-hmm. How did you get drawn into the world of architecture?
I was always interested in Legos and building things, just as pretty much every other architect was. So I went to school at Ball State here in Indiana, studied architecture there, and then came out of school and immediately started working for a small firm that did residential work and fell in love with it. Residential work is so personal. It involves meeting with a client that is going to be living with this piece of art that you're developing on a daily basis. So it was really exciting to be able to work on a project type that's so personal.
So I've always wondered, obviously, one of the outcomes of people going on this tour will be, I've been looking for the right architect to design my house. I love that house at 429 Pennsylvania, or, you know, whichever address calls out to you. So then they come to you and they say, I love that house that you did for so-and-so at such and such an address. How do you encourage them to not have you copy something you've done for someone else? How do you draw them out to get their own ideas about something that will be very personal and suit them?
Sure, and that's a great question, because I've had that question asked of me several times. And what I typically do is ask for the homeowners to step back for a minute and just think about how they live, how they go about their normal life, what kind of things excite them, what kind of things they've seen that really kind of prick their interest, and then start with them down a process, down a path where we'll capture images of things that we like. We'll take notes on things that we would like to see happen. And we start to develop a conceptual arrangement of a future building around ideas more than around an actual physical object that we've seen.
Have you ever been asked to do something that's just flat impossible?
I have. I could say that, you know, as an architect, something we always deal with is balancing the program with the budget. It's really difficult sometimes to...
Thank you, Frank Lloyd Wright.
Exactly.
Cost overruns, I'm shocked.
it's an architect. You know, we love to be able to give the owner everything that they're dreaming of. But sometimes it's just not possible. So what that really does for us as designers is it really forces us to become even more creative. So we have to really dig down and get to the root of the dream that the owner is after and see if there's a way that we can arrive at that dream through a different means.
Smart. So you have to be part psychologist, too.
We do. Sometimes family or marriage therapist as well.
Just let it go, husband of mine. We're not going to have that in the kitchen. And that's where the architect steps in to make peace. I can see it now. Hey, speaking of people commissioning, I understand that there was a couple who came to your last tour who ended up getting so excited that they had a house built. Is that right? And they're on this tour.
That's right. And you know, as an AIA architect here in Indianapolis, we've had a lot of really loyal people coming through our tours just year after year. And I remember this, as you were mentioning, this couple had had seen this tour in the past, and they were interested in the homes that they saw. And so they remembered that and contacted me later to come design a home for them.
And where did you start with that? What was their vision?
Their vision was to create a contemporary home near downtown Indianapolis, but it was in a wooded parcel on a creek that also happens to be in a floodplain. So there were a lot of challenges with this particular site. But this couple had a vision. They were really thinking outside the box. So it was a very complicated process to get to where we ended up. But I'm proud to say that the homeowners are now living a home that's truly about them. It was a design process that really evolved around their lifestyle. And the home that you'll see today on the tour reflects their personality.
Something about reclaimed wood pallets? Is that part of their house?
That is a different project. That is a home.
Okay.
You will also see that project on the tour this year. If you like Broad Ripple and the Monon Trail, you may have seen that project under construction this past summer. That project is just north of Broad Ripple, designed by Paul Puzello and Wes Jantz, who are Ball State architecture professors. That home is truly unique, and the structure that you're referring to is, as far as we're aware, it's the first pallet-only structure that was permitted in the entire U.S.
Oh, my gosh. So, wait. So pallets are strong enough to build with?
Apparently so. They can be, for sure.
Not to scare anyone, but
no,
wow.
Absolutely not. But you would certainly need to ask Paul and Wes about the process, because it was, I know that for them, they had a dream of really being able to be green with their structure. And so making use of these reclaimed pallets was a way of repurposing something that had been discarded. It was, I know it was a challenge getting through the permitting process, but also a very rewarding one.
Hmm. So it sounds as though all of these houses are strikingly different.
They certainly are. They're all fairly close to downtown, but they're all in very different settings. For example, we have one that happens to be in a historic neighborhood. We have one that's a couple of them that are in wooded parcels, just a little bit outside of the downtown area. And what you'll also see is the architects and designers involved have very different backgrounds. You'll see that one of the designers is a very recent college graduate who was involved in the solar decathlon project in Washington, D.C., and he brought back a lot of lessons he learned through that and implemented that in his design. At the other end of the perspective, you'll see a home designed by Jim McQuiston, who is a seasoned architect here in Indianapolis, has done a lot of great work, and was also involved in the addition and renovation of the governor's residence. So you'll clearly see some very kind of a broad range of perspectives from these different designers.
One of the great things about home tours is you, as a tour goer, you always get to go in and look at things and go, I could adapt that idea to my house. But this, it strikes me as so different because I'm guessing the owners are going to be there as well as the architects, right?
Many of the owners will be there.
But this offers the additional opportunity to actually talk to the person who designed the home. What sorts of things, if you were advising people who are going to go on this tour, what sorts of things might we look for that we might not normally get to look for or talk about?
Well, Sharon, that's an interesting question. Something that we're looking to do this year on the tour is the architects are going to go back into their early design concept sketches.
Oh, cool.
And going to package them in a way that they can demonstrate to the tour visitors a little bit of the process that they went through to get to the final product. And as you look around today, you'll see a lot of wonderful pieces of architecture out there. But to understand how the design team got there is what is truly going to be unique about this tour. We're hopeful that the tour goers will be able to peek inside the mind a little bit of the design process. And so back to your question, what homeowners might look for or visitors on the tour, some things that they might want to keep in mind, is that it really is about a process. And so there's a lot of dreams and goals that homeowners may have as they begin a process, and they have to balance their dreams and goals with their budget and various code constraints. But to truly maintain that open, broad vision of what's possible, I guess I would just comment that there's endless opportunities for creativity if a homeowner is willing to balance their needs and creativity with their budget and constraints.
Sure. All of these homes are fairly recent, but most of them have been lived in for a year or more by their homeowners, right?
That's probably right. We have a couple projects that are just wrapping up right now, finishing construction, but there's also a few that have been lived in for a while. We have one project that's actually a renovation, so the homeowners have been there for many years, mm-hmm. and they recently decided to upgrade, and they did an extensive renovation to modernize their home, and they put a very interesting new contemporary twist on an older home.
Ooh, I love that. I bought a 1909 home a few years ago, and one of the pieces of advice I read was, don't change anything radically until you've been in the house at least a year, so you know how you live in it. And that's where my question about homeowners being in there for a while, because how you live in a house changes after you've been there a while.
Oh, absolutely, it does. And I've even commented to homeowners in the past that, you know, it's not a bad idea to go ahead and live in a home with white walls for a little while before we select paint colors, because you'll know that as soon as you move in, furniture could change, different wall hangings and artwork could change, and the way a light travels across the wall can be dramatically different from season to season.
Sure.
So to live in a home for a little while will allow the homeowner to really kind of experience how the room really kind of changes from day to day. And paint colors may actually be something that you'd want to wait on until you get a better sense of what the space really feels like.
There's that traffic issue too. You might think when you're designing a home or looking at a home that's already built, oh, this is the room I'm going to live in, and then you're there for a while and you realize, I never go in that room.
You're absolutely right. It seems like the spaces that we sometimes that we forget about a little bit tend to be the spaces that we really live in, and it's really fun to work with a homeowner and get into the background about how do you normally live on a day-to-day basis and really kind of break that down. And you find out that the kitchen is a really important space, and maybe a homeowner didn't realize that at first, but it starts to really come out through conversation, and so you can really develop a program and then a budget that works to how the homeowner really lives.
Is there a kind of home you'd like to design, or a particular feature you'd like to design that you haven't been asked by a client to design yet? Is there something where you're just saying, oh, I just need the right client, so I can build my fill-in-the-blank?
Yes, you're absolutely right on that point. I think a lot of architects here in the city would probably have a lot that they would like to offer to that question. And I think from my standpoint, it revolves around what the budget is, how to react to the budget. There's a lot of new contemporary materials and systems out there that are very efficient and green and very high technology. I would love to use a lot of these new products, and sometimes we have to be selective with how we incorporate them. Maybe in a project we can balance our budget and incorporate a couple of these new modern features, but it's difficult sometimes to really pack in a lot of the exciting things that are being developed on a daily basis into one home.
So let's see, artist, scientist, financial analyst, marital counselor. Who knew that you were going to need to be all of those?
Oh, Sharon, you make me feel really tired now as I hear
this. Oh, so sorry.
But it is a lot of fun. It's a very rewarding project. It's a field where the work that we do is out there on display for everyone to drive past and to admire as well as critique. So, you know, a lot of what we do, we have to be willing to take criticism and react to it and respond. And you know, as I mentioned before, the way that the technology is constantly changing, you know, we as designers need to be constantly evolving our design to look for ways to be constantly more energy efficient and more sustainable and then also be just up to the times with how people live. So, you know, our design process constantly has to evolve throughout our career.
Sharon Gamble with Mark Beebe, chair of this year's Architects Home Tour. It's a self-guided tour of 7 architect-designed homes in Indianapolis. You'll be able to talk with the architect and the homeowner in each home. Learn more and get tickets at aiahometour.org. Again, that's aiahometour.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Author Barb Shoup's new novel is titled An American Tune. Published by Indiana University Press, the book opens with Nora Quillen reluctantly accompanying her husband and daughter to freshman orientation at Indiana University when she hears someone call her name, a name she has not heard in more than 25 years. Not even her husband knows that back in the 60s she was Jane Barth, a student deeply involved in the anti-war movement. Travis DiNicola spoke with Barb about the new novel, which is being released this week.
Barb, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always a pleasure to have you here.
Always a pleasure to be here.
And congratulations on the publication of your new book, An American Tune.
Thank you.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, Barb. What's the saying about if you remember the 60s, you weren't there? So if you write about the 60s, how does that work for you?
Well, it's funny. I wasn't there in the 60s in the way that you mean. Mm-hmm. I was a pretty conservative person at that point. I married when I was really young and had children. And so I really wasn't involved in any of that in stuff at the time.
Okay.
But yet it had a huge effect on the way I think and the way I am. Sometimes I think it maybe had more effect on me than it had on the effect or that it had on the people who actually lived through it and were involved in all the political stuff, because so many of them, you know, for the most part, we end up like our parents, whether we plan to or not. And so after we sow those oats, we kind of revert. But I think I have really taken on those kinds of values. I really did believe in them, and I still believe in them now. So even though I wasn't involved in the way a lot of people were, I think I am a person of the 60s. So I was there, but not there. And
so then is this book a way to sort of live through some of that? Or
it is.
Maybe experience some of the things that you know, sort of saw or heard about, but
no, not so much that. I had a friend who was very much involved in the political part of the 60s and who ended up in a situation that really changed the course of her life in a drastic way. And that was and remains a mystery to me. So part of my interest was that I am very curious about how people cross that line between being really passionate about something and really doing something that is going to follow them for the rest of their lives, not in a happy kind of way. So I was interested in that, and like I said, have been interested always in that. So that's a lot of where it came from. It also seemed to me that as we were kind of living the run-up to the Iraq War, that a lot of the things that we were thinking about and talking about and a lot of things that were happening were very much parallel to the 60s. They didn't turn out so well in the 60s, and I'm not thinking they turned out so well for us, really, with Iraq either. And so I was thinking about that. The book takes place, the now of the novel, is in the months, probably, let's see, it would be July 2002 through the early summer of 2003. So there was the run-up to the war, the beginning of the war, and mission accomplished and all that. And so I was interested in the parallel there.
Okay.
And so that had a lot to do with it as well.
The book's also about, from my understanding, and again, I haven't had a chance to read it yet. It's just coming out right now.
It's so exciting.
I'm looking forward to being able to read my copy. But it seems like the book is also really exploring reinvention of oneself. I mean, what happens when one sort of moves forward past something that they experience and tries to sort of maybe get away from it and reinvent and then has to confront that? Is that?
Well, in a way, yeah, because the main character went underground at some point mm-hmm. and started a whole new life, reinvented herself, and nobody knew, mm-hmm. Not her husband, not her daughter, nobody in her life as an adult. And so the book begins when she comes with her daughter for orientation at Indiana University. She did not want her daughter to go to Indiana University. The girl is a music major, so it's a natural choice for her. But, of course, she can't say why. Mm-hmm. And she comes to orientation against her better judgment and is sitting in what we used to call People's Park, but is okay. I'm not sure what it is now. But anyway, she's kind of by herself, and she's thinking and remembering also in a way that she doesn't particularly want to. But by the end of the first chapter, somebody calls her by a different name. So the reader knows that,
sure.
that's what's going on. So then we go backwards and find mm-hmm. the story of how she got to where she is. And so, yeah, it is about a person who, from necessity, reinvents mm-hmm. herself and then finds that the secrets that she kept have done more damage than she might have imagined, and her life begins to unravel. So it's about secrets, too.
Sure.
I think keeping secrets from the people that you love is a dangerous sort of thing.
In this case, I mean, her family,
her
family. Husband, her children.
Yeah, I mean, the most important people in her life didn't know who she was, mm-hmm. really. She lost contact with her parents, her sisters, mm-hmm. And that was a terrible thing when it all kind of came back to hit her.
Sure.
You can do that for a while, maybe. Maybe you can do it forever, but the moment at which you can't do it, you really can't do it.
Yep.
And it really comes back to bite you. And also, I think in some ways, the main character is like me. She took a different direction in her life. But I realized at some point in my writing life that a lot of it had to do with reimagining what my life might have been like
okay.
under different circumstances. Because I, mm-hmm. A lot of this book is set at IU, which is where I went, and where I met my husband on the first day that I was on campus as a freshman. So I think, well, what if that had happened a different way?
And sort of a parallel universe, maybe.
A parallel universe, yeah. And so in a lot of ways, this book is sort of like a parallel universe for me, because she does kind of meet a guy on mm-hmm. the first day that she's there and establishes a really important relationship, but it goes in a completely different direction.
And part of the book is also set in Michigan, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where she ends up,
mm-hmm.
in northern
okay.
Michigan, in a little beach town up near Sleeping Bear Dunes in northern Michigan, which is a place that I really love.
Mm-hmm.
We have a little house up there and have spent lots of time up there over you know, a period of about 30 years. So
sure.
It was fun to write about that place because I love it so much.
So where's the title, An American Tune, come from?
The title comes from a Paul Simon song of the same name, mm-hmm. An American Tune.
Yeah.
It's a very sad and beautiful song, and I think it has a lot to say about my generation.
Yeah. You've been living with this book quite a while, working on this. It's got to be a really exciting time right now, not only to have the book released, but also in the coming weeks, you're going to be honored through the Indiana Authors Award for the Regional Author Award. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. I'm thrilled about that.
Have you thought about what you're going to say that night?
No, I'm scared to death. I really am. There's nothing sort of more wonderful than to be honored by your own community, I think, and especially
yeah.
the library. I'm such a library person that I can't really imagine anything better than that. So I'm pondering that.
Well, you're in some pretty good company, of course.
I am in really good company.
I mean, you know, Dan Wakefield,
which is sort of what makes me so
John
nervous.
Green, I mean, you know.
And the emerging writers are wonderful, too.
Yes.
I hadn't read them before, and so now I'm in the process of reading those books before mm-hmm. that evening and enjoying them a lot. So, yeah, I'm a lucky person right now.
Yeah, it's a good time for Barb Shoup right
now. It's a very nice time, yeah.
Which then, of course, leads to what's next? You're continuing, of course, your work with the Writers' Center.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
and as the director there, and working on other things as well, I'm sure.
I've always got things that I'm working on.
Yeah.
And I haven't I haven't really focused. It's hard in between books, you know, because I worked on An American Tune. I started that book in 2003, I guess.
Oh, okay.
And so I've been working on it for a really, really long time.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, where do you go then? You know, you mm-hmm. get up for your writing time and all those people are finished. So I need to find a new set of people that I feel. I have about three different things that I've got in process, but I don't know which one yet is going to sort of take.
Now, I certainly have not read all of your work, Barb, but what I have read, I've enjoyed very much.
Thank you.
But American Tune, just from, again, from what I've heard about it, it sounds a little bit more, maybe a little bit more serious, a little bit more contemplative than mm-hmm. some of your other work.
It is. Well, the young adult books are, I mean, I think they're serious if you're a yeah. young adult. They deal with serious issues, but they're not the same as this book. I think this book was the book I was trying to write all my life, really.
Really?
Yeah, because it's an interesting time in life. I was 65 this year, and, you know, you can kind of look back on your life, and you see it's like a map that mm-hmm. you didn't realize at the time what was happening and how it was all connected. But now you can look back and you see, oh, I see exactly why
and
things...
It starts to make sense?
It starts to make sense.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. It was an interesting way... The book was an interesting way to think about some of that stuff. Hmm. You know, growing older and what you thought when you were young and how you were wrong and in other ways you were absolutely right. How things played out, how they might have played out in other ways. And so it was an introspective process, maybe more so than some books. Although I have to say, with everything I do, there's always a question behind it that I'm trying to answer mm-hmm. for myself. I mean, it's really all about me. And so this book, yeah, I mean, it was about the difference between yourself as a young person and an older person and the things maybe you wish you would have known when you were younger, but it's okay that you didn't because things turned out all right anyway. But yeah, I mean, it probably is a more introspective book.
So when you were writing, though, about this, not yourself, but the main character's younger self.
Yes.
And going back in time, back to the 60s, how did you, I mean, what sort of research was involved in terms of, you know, trying to get it right, trying to be authentic to the time, and trying not to just make it something that was seen through, you know, the pink glass of the rose glass of memory
yeah. Well, I don't have a rose glass memory.
Okay.
I have a tendency to go the other way, and not necessarily so much for this book. But I think part of what you do as a writer is you get right back in that place. And I when I write for young adults, I just write from the place where I am a teenager still and always will be. And so with that, with An American Tune, I really found myself being that young person again, which I have to say was kind of disconcerting, you know.
How do you do, I mean, is it a matter of, you know, putting on some old music?
No,
just,
it's
sort
not
of
for
just
me.
Really, you know, I mean, was it looking at old pictures or just kind of really just in your own mind saying,
I was just there.
This is getting
when
back
I once I would get the flow going
yeah.
with the writing and I, you know, I would see it in my mind's eye, then I just was that person.
Was that then hard for you to sort of get out of at the end
yeah.
of the writing day?
It was sometimes.
Yeah.
And I would suddenly think, I miss my young husband, you know, or what happened there? I mean, I really love him now, but gosh, where did he go and where did I go? And what about all of our friends? And I mean, the aging process is very, very strange. You don't mm-hmm. feel any different inside than you did when you were 18, but yet you look in the mirror and you don't look the same.
Mm-hmm.
So it was disconcerting at times to feel like I really was that young person again, and then to come out of it and be who I am now.
Yeah.
It's
then,
all true.
Then go look in the mirror and make dinner. And
yeah, it was strange and sort of wonderful in a way, but it made me melancholy sometimes.
Huh. Oh, wow. Well, I am looking forward very much to reading An American Tune, Barb. Always a pleasure to have you on Art of the Matter.
I love being on Art of the Matter.
Thanks. We're really looking forward to having you at Indie Reads Books.
Am I looking forward to that. That's
going to
be fun.
So you'll be reading, of course, from
yes,
American
I
Tune
will.
That night.
Indie Reads Books is fabulous.
Well, thank you.
You guys are having such great things going on there now, and it's become already a center for writers and writing and reading.
Well, that's very, you know, one thing that's very exciting that I just want to mention is that, you know, in addition to having you reading there on the 28th of September, we've had Dan Wakefield, we've had John Green, and so here are the three winners of this year's Indiana Authors Awards that we've been able to
have
in the bookstore, which is, I think is a pretty cool
thing. It's very cool.
Yeah. So anyways, well, we're looking forward to that as well. Barb, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Matter today.
My pleasure. Hope you enjoy the book.
Travis DiNicola with author Barb Shoup. Her new novel, An American Tune, has just been published by Indiana University Press. There will be a book launch party at Indy Reads Books at 6 p.m. on Friday, September 28th. More information is at indyreadsbooks.org. You can also visit Barb's website at barbarashoup.com, and that's S-H-O-U-P, barbarashoup.com.
Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
What do the following have in common?
Uh-oh.
Jazz.
Yes.
Eight Sister Cities.
Yes.
And Ireland.
Oh, and may I add one more?
Go right ahead.
Spanish-speaking countries.
Then you must have figured out that this is like Fest weekend.
It really is.
It is.
It's
I mean,
fantastic.
We got Irish Fest, we got Jazz Fest.
We got Fiesta.
We got Sister City Fest. That's right. Oh, Fiesta. Oh, my gosh. There's so much going on this weekend. Yes?
And we'll tell you about on our calendar. We call.
What do we do?
Festival-wise and otherwise.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, Jazz Fest, you know, has been going on all week, but concludes this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, of course, up at the Optimus Park at Broad Ripple, right across from the Indianapolis Arts Center.
The place to be. Great shows going on.
Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, into the evening, both nights. Looking forward to that very much.
Mm-hmm. This Saturday from noon to midnight, Fiesta downtown on the Mall. If you're hearing us Saturday afternoon, get your dancing shoes out because it's Saturday night when it really cooks. Two stages of dance music at Fiesta.
That's right. And then Irish Fest down at Military Park on the campus of IUPUI, and that goes Saturday and Sunday with lots of great Irish food.
Aren't there some small furry animals at Irish Fest?
And of course, they got Irish sheepdogs and goat herding exhibits and kilts and Guinness and more Guinness. We love Irish Fest.
And toasting.
Right. And toast, Irish toast.
Oh, there you go.
And lots of great stuff.
What else do you have?
Let's see. And then the Sister City Festival, which we talked about last weekend on Art of the Matter. But this is a new festival that's going on until 6 p.m. on Saturday. And it takes place at the City Market. And it is free. And it's a celebration of Indianapolis's eight sister cities and the countries that they're located
Name
in.
Name two of them.
I can tell you Ireland and India are two of the countries represented by one band, which is pretty fun.
What?
Yes, it's an Irish band it's a band from Canada using Irish instruments playing Indian bongo music. Should be fun. That's going on late this afternoon.
Say that one more
on
time.
On Saturday. Yep.
Irish?
Yeah. Canadian, Irish, Indian.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like it.
There you go.
Little world music. I love it.
What else you got?
Well, this Saturday night at 7:30, Kellyn Strutz is back with the Indiana Wind Symphony playing the Rhapsody in Blue. A lot of Gershwin on this program, including selections from Porgy and Bess. Strike up the band, Someone to Watch Over Me, and They Can't Take That Away from Me. All sorts of tuneful things, and a little bit of contemporary music as well by Joan Tower. So all of that is going on at the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts this Saturday night at 7:30.
Very cool. Hey, something to put on your calendar for Saturday, September 22nd, up in Carmel, at the gazebo in Carmel, is something called the Goodstock Music Fest. It's taking place from 6 to 10 that night, and it is featuring a lot of local musicians, and the whole thing is a fundraiser for a man named Josh Shepherd, and he was unfortunately electrocuted while working on the Indiana Pipeline. And
oh, dear.
And his father's a musician, and this is a fundraiser to raise money, of course, to help Josh Shepherd out. But it's featuring a whole bunch of music, include his father's Michael Shepherd's All-Star Review, a lot of great country music, as well as the ZMC Band, and then the Wright Brothers Band. And people, of course, heard of them, old favorites. They're going to be playing at 8:15 that night. There's going to be a bunch of food trucks there and silent auction. And again, you can get more information at goodstockmusicfest.com, September 22nd. At the Carmel Gazebo.
Very good. Hey, we were talking about, I all things Irish a minute ago, an Irish festival. Well, you don't have to stop thinking about the Irish at the end of Irish Fest this weekend, because next weekend, on the 22nd, from 7:30 to 9:30 at the Basile Theater at the Indiana History Center, you can hear a storyteller who's going to tell you about mad myths of the Irish. Her name is Claire Murphy. I think she comes by it naturally. She'll take you on a blind and dark and ferocious journey where warriors leap with frenzy, one-eyed monsters hunt the shores, and shapeshifters blur the line from this world to the ever-so-close other world. There will be fairies and fallen gods and all sorts of dark and spooky and creepy and amusing stories as part of Claire Murphy's Stories, The Mad Myths of the Irish, part of Storytelling Arts of Indiana's new season. Again, that is next Saturday, the 22nd, 7:30, the Basile Theater at the Indiana History Center. More Irish.
Cool. Very cool. Hey, you've heard us talk quite a lot about, of course, the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. We've had Dan Wakefield on, and on today's show we just heard from Barb Shoup. We're also going to have John Green on soon. The award ceremony is the evening of Saturday, September 29th, but during that day is an event called the Indie Author Fair, and this is put on by the library and the Library Foundation, and it's part of the whole Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award festivities. And in fact, they're partnering with the Writers Center as well, and it's a full day of free public programming for writers and readers, including opportunities to basically meet and mingle with all of the authors being honored this year and a whole bunch of others. There's also great workshops on getting published and how to market your mystery or write a book proposal or things like that. Just a great day. It's all taking place at the Central Library from 10 until 4:30 on Saturday, September 29th. You get more information at the library's website.
Speaking of things literary, don't forget, on stage right now at the Indiana Repertory Theater is The Chilling Tale. I seem to be on a spooky, creepy story jag here on my calendar items. The Chilling Tale of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Whoa. Which is so much fun. I got to see it last weekend.
Yay! Love that.
I got to just say something, Sharon.
Uh-oh.
Pay attention to the floor. I've never seen a theater production where the floor made such an impact on the whole production.
Wow.
It's obviously a part of the set, but they use the floor in a really interesting way to set the tone and to change the scene. And the more Hyde there is, the more things that are happening on the floor. It's pretty cool.
Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, and the floor.
And the floor.
Through September 30th at the IRT. No, seriously, thanks for that tip.
Yeah.
It might make you want to purchase a balcony
seat,
too.
It's a great show to see from the balcony. Yeah, because
it's
a beautiful set.
Thanks for the tip. Appreciate
that. You're welcome. Hey, I'm on kind of a literary kick, I guess, and I wanted to mention some stuff coming up at Book Mama's, which is that great bookstore in Irvington, on Friday, September 21st from 7 to 9. Dean Phelps will be performing his toe-tapping fun songs on acoustic guitar, and he's a lot of fun there. And then also something they're doing that's kind of cool, continuing through October, and this taps into your sort of spooky stuff, Cheryl. They're an exhibit of the Day of the Dead with themed artist trading cards is taking
place. I love those trading cards.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite things.
And so this is going on at Book Mama's, and artists can actually decorate playing card-sized trading cards with a Day of the Dead theme. You can bring them in, look at others, trade them, all that sort of stuff. There's even going to be a craft-making workshop later in November. Very fun stuff. We'll talk about that as we get closer to it. But always cool stuff worth checking out at Book Mama's in Irvington.
Well, since we're on the mysterious and creepy path here, I'm just going to bring this to your attention. It doesn't start until October 20th, but down at the Cincinnati Shakespeare Festival, which despite its name is a regular theatrical series.
Not just Shakespeare.
However, Titus Andronicus, which you don't get a chance to see terribly often, is their presentation opening October 20th. The mighty Roman general faces off with his mortal enemy, and it's bloody, 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 violent, bloody, and they are known.
Ooh,
CSF, Cincinnati Shakespeare Fest, is known for very stylish productions, so you can find out more online, just a couple hours away, to see a bloody, violent Shakespeare production. Probably don't want to take young children to that one. I'm just saying.
Probably not.
I don't know. It depends on what kind of parent you are, I suppose.
Spooky literary. Sharon, there's so much going on. We've got to get out and get to those festivals right
we
now.
We do.
We are running out of time.
You've been practicing your toast.
So we will be back next week with more things to do on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Composer Nat Evans lives in Seattle now, but he graduated from Butler and has a fondness for Indianapolis. Last year, he created a site-specific composition and performance here, and he has a new project coming up on September 20th at the 100 Acres Lake on the grounds of the IMA. Sharon Gamble called Nat to learn more about Hungry Ghosts.
Our regular listeners know that you have a great love for site-specific performances, but I want to find out, first of all, where you came across this idea of the lanterns and the Chinese and Japanese ghost festival. Where did you encounter that?
I've encountered that through my own practice in Zen. Obon is celebrated in, you know, every Zen temple and community. And also in Seattle, there is a large, big Obonodori festival here. And so they actually do the lanterns on a lake out here. And so, yeah, that's where I first came across it and then just sort of investigated it further and kind of eventually it seemed like something that would really speak to what I'm interested in creating musically, and I have a lot of thoughts about my own ancestors musically and familiarly and otherwise, so it just kind of came together.
Do you know a lot about your ancestors?
I know, well, the piece itself is about, like, some family ancestors and some musical ancestors. I actually probably know more about some of my musical ancestors than I do some of my family. But I know a fair bit, probably more than most people in America. Like, I had, I'm related to Cotton Mather, the Salem Witch Trials drug.
Ooh, cool.
Yeah, the judge there. And I'm also, let's see, there was another Mather who was an early president of Harvard. Some of my family came over on the second voyage of the Mayflower. So I do know some. It's kind of always in the back of my mind, I suppose.
Sure, sure. And who among your musical ancestors do you relate to most?
Well, in the piece, the people who I bring in are Chinese scholars who are... One of the things that ancient Chinese scholars have done since time immemorial is they play this instrument called the qin, which is meant to be played in a room for just a few people. And so they would take the qin out up into the mountains and listen to all the different sounds that they were encountering and then write some kind of musical response to that, which is in a lot of ways it's really similar to, like, using a field recording, like so many composers, including myself, do. And, of course, I mean, you could extrapolate further and say that, you know, responding musically to natural sounds might be the birthplace of, you know, human language and a lot of other things. So that's one of my... I look back to that. And more immediately, in the piece, there are homages to... Lamont Young and Terry Riley, and then also to poet Gary Snyder, and I feel like a lot of his poetry is wrapped up in Zen, and also it brings attention to sounds a lot, just because of the awareness that it creates.
Sure. What is a qin like, for those of our listeners who are not familiar?
Sorry. The qin is a zither-like instrument.
Ah.
Yeah, it looks kind of like a longer and more rounded lap steel guitar, I guess. And it's that's the kind of shape. But it sounds completely different, and it has a empty resonating chamber on the underside of it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds beautiful.
It's really great.
Is there something in your instrumentation that, I realize you're talking about a big picture idea here, but did you try to imitate the sound of the djinn at all in your instrumentation?
No. In one of the movements that it specifically focuses on the Chinese scholar ancestors. And so the players are instructed to listen more closely to sounds in their everyday lives and then come up with their own sort of response to that. So that's all going to be kind of going on simultaneously.
Oh, cool. So is there some relationship to chance music here or no?
To some indeterminacy?
Yeah.
There's definitely a lot of that in the score. There are a number of things that are left up to the players. And that relates back to some of the musical ancestors that I talked about there, especially, of course, John Cage. Happy birthday to him next Wednesday.
There you 100th, go.
100th birthday. amongst others, helped bring chance and indeterminacy into music in a serious way, for sure. So there's a lot of that in the score. I also use that anyway in some of my other pieces, but yeah. So players have to make choices about what they play when. In the case of that movement from the Chinese scholar's perspective, they have to respond in an immediate way to sounds in their environment.
Who comprises the Jordan College of Fine Arts Composers Orchestra? Is this a subset of the Butler Symphony, or what's the personnel here?
It is. It's a class that is anybody who is a composition major at Butler is in the Composers Orchestra, and then there's also other people who just want to be in an ensemble that plays more experimental music and music written by their peers. And so that combined, and it makes up the orchestra. And then they also bring in, you know, other people. It's like, hey, you know, we need an extra whatever violin for this, and so they'll pull in someone for it. And then it's run by Mike Shelley and Frank Felice, mm-hmm. the composition teachers there.
So these are players who are accustomed to being asked to do some unusual things musically. However, they're not just playing experimental music. They're playing in an unusual setting. Normally, you'd expect to find them on a stage, but the stage in this case is they're in the boats?
That's right, yeah. So I'm asking a lot of them. There are going to be 9 boats out on the 100 Acres Sculpture Park Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's going to be a player in each boat out there. It's going to be, I'm not sure if it'll be more difficult, but it'll be a challenge adjusting to a new way of listening and playing. And then the people who come to the event will be able to walk around the lake and hear the music as it changes from their location as it changes over time.
So that's going to be fun logistically too. This piece is, I think it is not a coincidence that it's being performed at the Equinox. Is there some particular call to spirits that happens at the changing of the seasons? Is it easier for spirits to come to us, to communicate with us?
In traditional cultures, then it, like in Japan, China, Thailand, then it's actually usually held in around late July, early August. But in this case, it just seemed like an appropriate time to be able to, celebrate our ancestors and look at our own lives.
Sure.
Because, you know, the fall equinox is a time when we're shifting into a new phase of the year, and So,
in many cases, moving more indoors and starting to be more contemplative too.
Mm-hmm. True.
Why are these ghosts hungry? Are they hungry to communicate?
So the story of these ancestor festivals, it's drawn from early Buddhism. One of the Buddha's adherents had some magical powers, and he was able to see into different realms of existence. And so he observed his own mother trapped in the hungry ghost realm. It's one of the places where in Buddhist mythology that you could end up after you die as you're reincarnated.
Ah.
So his mother had passed away and was in the hungry ghost realm, and she was calling out, and the ancestors themselves aren't necessarily hungry ghosts, but they are sort of in the festivals. They're just sort of thought of as being ghosts that can be drawn back, whether they're in the hungry ghost realm or whatever, wherever they are, you know, in the universe, whatever your beliefs are. There are offerings of food that are put out to draw them back from those realms. And then the lanterns are a way at the end to sort of send them home back to their realm.
Light their way safely home.
Jaron Gamble with composer Nat Evans. Nat's Hungry Ghost will be performed by musicians in boats on the 100 Acres Lake at the Indianapolis Museum of Art on Thursday, September 20th at 7:30. If you'd like to make a lantern, you can come at 6:30 for a workshop at the lake shore. Both events are free and part of the IMA's Fall Equinox celebration. And right now we're listening to an excerpt from Nat Evans' Hungry Ghosts.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 when I find out about the IMA's Contemporary Arts Society's 50th anniversary.
On the visual art scene, I'll get a preview of a visual art exhibit for the visually impaired.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I also get to chat with Mark Motherbaugh of Devo.
Whip it good.
Plus, we'll have that calendar of events we call
What Will We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter. Seriously, Devo, right?
Right.
Here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.